My name is Greg Jackson. I'm a PhD holding historian, a professor, and the creator of History That Doesn't Suck, a podcast that makes legit, seriously researched American history come to life through entertaining stories. Join me for a chronological telling of the United States story, from the Revolution to fractious Civil War, tenacious inventors, brave reformers, and more. With more than 100 episodes, you can already binge listen your way from 1776 to the early 20th century. Listen to History That Doesn't Suck on Spotify.
My friends, Takuya here.
And I'm Gabby.
And welcome back to the podcast, my hoes. Welcome back. And from the very beginning, we have something that needs to be said.
I am incredibly sick. So 2 weeks ago, I had a sinus infection. The medicine they gave me for the sinus infection gave me esophagitis. After esophagitis, as soon as I started to feel a little bit better, I now have a cold. No clue. I'm just not feeling well. So I'm apologizing now if I sound strange. I'm very sorry.
If you hear any coughs, if you hear anything that happens in the background or in here, again, we formally do apologize. For whatever reason, sickness seems to work like a cycle in this house where one person gets it, it moves on to the next, and then subsequently 3 weeks later, it's back to the original, which in turn means that we all end up suffering. I don't know why that is the case, but speaking of suffering, how about a story of how about 6 million people plus were killed?
What?
Yeah, that's the
I thought this was Napoleon.
This is Napoleon.
What?
Do you have any idea how many people died over the course of the Napoleonic Wars, Gabby?
Apparently 6 million people and counting.
Literally due to direct conflict, disease, starvation, everything. Hundreds of thousands, millions of people died across Europe as a result of Napoleon's wars. Like, it is truly an insane amount. Now, from the beginning going into this, I'm going to preface this by saying that this is going to be a multi-part storyline. I know that I said I wasn't going to do more, okay? But you literally cannot tell the story of Napoleon without actually having his complete story. What am I going to do? Skip through all of this and tell a complete summary of his life and everything that he did in the span of like 20 minutes?
Yes.
No. God, no.
Ridley Scott did it. You can. Well, he took 3 hours.
No, he didn't even do that, Gabby, because 2.5 of those 3 hours were Josephine.
And honestly, we need to highlight more women in history. Guys, don't cancel me. I'm joking, please.
Anyway, what we're going to be doing here today is a two-part series. It is going to be the rise of Napoleon, and then you can subsequently guess after that, the fall of Napoleon. We're going to be moving pretty quickly through all of this, though. Not quite as quick as Ridley Scott did, from skipping over any number of things that were actually extremely important, but we are still going to be going into things rather fast, and from that, if there is anything that we do miss in this, I apologize. You can send an angry email if you want, but you're not changing anything right now, since, go figure, you already listened to the episode. So Napoleon Bonaparte was born back in 1769. We've already covered kind of the background of everything that was going on here from when we did the 8-part series on the French Revolution. Wait, no, was it 8 or was it 7? We did a 7-part series on the French Revolution,
Nobody knows.
It just kept on going. It just kept on going and going and going. Anyway, Napoleon was not French. This is a common fact that people like to talk about him, or at least it's now more common since, you know, TikTok and the rise of short form content has become popular. But he was not French. He was Corsican. Specifically, you know, like from Corsica, this would be a region in Italy. It was one of the little islands that was there off the side. He was born to a minor Italian noble family. And he had 7 siblings, of which he was the 2nd oldest. The island of Corsica had been a position or possession of the Republic of Genoa, but this is something that had been ceded to France a year before Napoleon was born. Napoleon's father was a guy by the name of Carlo, and he would join Pascal Paoli in fighting against the French in order to try and get Corsican independence. But like many other independence movements at this time, that didn't exactly work out. They eventually were defeated. Weirdly enough, despite all of this, Carlo, his dad, actually became friends with the French governor of the island, a guy by the name of Charles. The two became so close that Charles eventually became Napoleon's godfather, and from there would watch over him as he would grow up. In fact, it's thanks to the fact that his father was friends with this governor guy, Charles would manage to secure a position for Carlo as the Corsican representative to the King Louis XVI, and from that, a spot for Napoleon and his older brother at the French Academy. And mind you, this is not like what it is that we have nowadays when it comes to education, where, yes, there are prestigious schools like in the Ivy Leagues, Harvard, Yale, Princeton, etc., where you pretty much have to know someone in order to get in. Back in the day, that is pretty much all that it was. In order to get admitted to kind of an academy like this, you had to have connections. You had to have ability and connections. And in this case, he finally had that. Problem, though, was that Napoleon was not French. His native language was Italian, and although he was sent to French boarding school from the age of 9, he would always speak French with a Corsican accent, and he had a lot of difficulty writing it in the first place, which I don't blame him. I hate anything to do with like writing or trying to read for anything for the French language. If you hear anything that I am mispronouncing over the course of this video, or the episode, depends on where you're actually seeing this, I'm sorry, but the amount of times that you read a word and then half of the vowels are silent? Not even the vowels. Half the word. Half the entire word is silent. Gabby, why?
French. But here's the thing. And also there's dialects too. So it gets even more confusing keeping track of all of that. But writing French is easy though. The writing is the easy part because you know what word you're writing. It's when you go to pronounce the word that it differs so widely. That part stresses me out.
Here's a word with 10 letters. I will pronounce 4 of them.
Yes, and then also change the pronunciation based on the accent marks.
Oh my God, see, this is what I'm talking about. And I guess this is one of the things that was pretty difficult for him. Because of his accent, because of his difficulties, because of all this, his classmates would bully him relentlessly. And while at school, he was oftentimes lonely, he was melancholic. Like, this is a guy that if he was in today's day and age, he would, and I'm saying this, I'm not saying this as a joke, I'm saying this as kind of a genuine statement, he is probably the guy that would end up being the one who gets violent as he grows older. Go figure, though. Back in the day, guess what he did?
He got violent as he grew older.
He got violent as he grew older. Yeah, yeah. So a thing would end up happening. His brother, for the longest time, was the only reason that he really stayed in school. And he might have dropped out after his father died. Because here's the big problem. With his father being dead, that meant that his family no longer was going to have the means by which they could pay for his schooling. Even though at the age of 15, he had been admitted to the École Militaire, like the military academy in Paris, where he would study to become an artillery officer, because his father died and he lost that source of income, he had two options, basically. Graduate early by like taking as many classes as possible, doing as much as he could to actually finish it, or drop out and get a job. Most people probably would have taken the option of just dropping out, but not Napoleon. No. He may have struggled with the French language, but he loved mathematics. He loved geography. He loved history. He loved all of his other classes, and he was able to throw himself into his work, and from that would become the first Corsican to graduate from the École Militaire. So upon his graduation, Napoleon would be commissioned as a second lieutenant in an artillery regiment that was stationed in eastern and southeastern France. However, Napoleon would spend most of his time on leave in Corsica. At one point, like, he spent so much time there rather than in France, because remember, he didn't really like it there at the time, especially as a younger man, that he was considered a deserter at some point because he was just absent from his post for so long. Then, of course, the big event happened. The thing that we spent all way too many weeks focusing on, the French Revolution. When the French Revolution broke out in 1789, Napoleon once again would return to Corsica, this time to promote the revolutionary cause. Not for Corsican independence, no. While he was on the island, he was actually caught up in a three-way power struggle between the royalists, the revolutionaries, and the Corsican nationalists. Despite the fact that he, you know, was a Corsican nationalist himself for the longest time, He instead joined the pro-French Corsican Republicans who opposed Corsican secession from France. And although he had exceeded his leave of absence from his artillery regiment, he did manage to be promoted to captain in the regular army. After this would happen, he would take part in a failed expedition into Sardinia that may have been sabotaged by its commanders, but was given command to capture Ajaccio, which was a fort that was held by Corsican volunteers on the west coast of Corsica. This mission would also fail, and after this, they would have to leave the island in control of the secessionists. The Corsican Assembly would condemn Napoleon and other members of his family because, you know, they had betrayed the cause, and for them, they were forced to flee back to the French mainland. Upon his return to France, though, Napoleon would rejoin his artillery regiment and would maintain his rank as captain of a coastal battery. The British Navy, French Royalists, and Allied forces had now at this point captured the port of Toulon in southeastern France, and Napoleon was appointed artillery commander of the force that was tasked with retaking the city. And I know this is one of the big points here that I focused on from the very beginning, because this is where, if anyone has seen the Ridley Scott movie here for Napoleon, that's where the story of Napoleon begins, is specifically at the Siege of Toulon.
That's where he was commanding everyone. They took the city and then he was celebrated.
Yes.
And he got to enter society and then he started staring awkwardly at Josephine.
Which,
guys, if you want to get a girl to talk to you, just, I guess, stare at her awkwardly.
Gabby.
That's bad advice. I'm sorry.
Gabby. No one can hear this right now, or no one can see this, but I'm staring at you intently while sitting in our dog's bed across the room.
I would love to laugh, but I can't, because I will cough.
Yes, I completely understand that. So, okay, the Siege of Toulon. There was this small fort that was overlooking the town, and it was held by Anglo-Allied forces. Napoleon had devised a plan to retake the fort and to place his artillery so that it would dominate both the town and the harbor. And in doing so, this would force the British to either mount a counterattack, which, mind you, would cause horrible amounts of casualties because they're attacking a fortified position, or they could withdraw from Toulon. Napoleon would lead his own daring attack on the fortified position while under intense bombardment. During the attack, he ended up being bayoneted in the leg, which, that sucks in the first place, but his forces would still manage to capture their objective. Within a few hours, the French artillery would open up on the British ships in the harbor, and Napoleon would actually do something very unique for a commander at the time. He would sight the guns himself.
Hello, my friends, Takuya here, and before we get back to the show, I would like to thank today's sponsor, Factor. For those of you who are not familiar with Factor and their never frozen meals, I have to say this is something that definitely helped me back when my house was being worked on this previous January, because for essentially 3 months, we didn't have a kitchen, which meant that Factor really did save our lives because we got this box in the mail that had all these fresh, never frozen meals that could be warmed up in simply like 2 minutes, and that's it. It was super easy to do, and since we didn't have an actual kitchen, just a microwave, this was a life changer for us. Every single meal was customized for what it is that we wanted. There were keto options, there were vegetarian options, there were many, many different forms. And this is something that is perfect for each and every person who can craft exactly what it is that they want. So I'm telling you this right now, if you want to make things easier for yourself this spring, then go to factormeals.com/historyofeverything50 and use code historyofeverything50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. It is just that easy, and I guarantee this is something that can help a lot of people. Hey everyone, it's Takuya here, and before we get back to the show, I would just like to thank today's sponsor, eBay Motors. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential, and then through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you can make sure that your ride stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, exhaust kits, turbochargers, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Usually, as a commanding officer, like this is something that you would give to a lower-ranking officer to do. No. For him, this was personal. And that is something that he would oftentimes do at random points in his military career later, even as like a full-scale general.
Explain sighting the gun.
Well, when you're having to sight a gun. The cannons are, they have to be aimed, right? So you have to be able to judge distance. You have to be able to judge the angle, because at this time, cannons are not necessarily standardized. They are somewhat standardized, but they're not completely standardized to the point that each gun is going to have its own kind of little unique quirks. It's going to have a slightly different aim. It's going to have a slightly different everything from the manufacturer it comes from the tools that was used to make it, from everything. You wouldn't have properly machined cannons that would be able to fire with more uniformity until actually Napoleon becomes, well, Emperor Napoleon later on. He is the guy that would try to standardize artillery for the French. And it was, oh my God, I don't even know how to begin to describe this. It's effective, mind you. When a commander doesn't have to take nearly as much time sighting each and every single gun and is able to instead know, hey, okay, with these weapons, that means I can just aim here, set it up, boom, we're ready. It is way less work to actually do, and the guns are way more accurate and more effective at killing your enemy. So he would sight the guns himself to specifically aim on the harbor, and the British fleet would try to then afterwards destroy the arsenal. And in their process of fleeing, they would try to evacuate as many royalists as they could, which was around 15,000 people. They then set fire to as many French ships as possible that they had captured, and after that, would flee from Toulon. The revolutionary forces would then retake Toulon, and after doing so, they would carry out reprisals on the royalist population that was still there. Thousands of people were shot, bayoneted, or guillotined. At one point, it was even proposed that every single civilian building within the city be burned to the ground so that it could not be used as a base of operation or a potential source of royalist sentiment again. Napoleon would escape most of these atrocities. And we're not saying that he was innocent in all of this. Absolutely not. It's just in this case, he had to actually recover from his leg wound, so he did not participate in this particular one. You can be sure that as time goes on, he was responsible for way, way, way more death. At one point, it was even thought that the leg wound that he had would cause his leg to be amputated. But Napoleon was eventually able to recover.
Didn't they just have to amputate a lot more than they would now anyway?
Oh, they did. They did. And it's for multiple reasons. So first off, let's say you have a gunshot, right? Guns back in the day had such a lower muzzle velocity in comparison to what they do now. Most rounds when they would fire, like, yes, they could go in and then out of you, but you had a significantly higher chance of an entry wound being made, but not an exit wound. So rounds had to be physically dug out of people's bodies. And then on top of that, when they're lodged inside of there, because remember, these things are made of lead, that means lead poisoning. A whole bunch of these things would, because they didn't, you know, have antibiotics or any of this stuff, you'd get gangrene, like this stuff would fester, which meant that you got shot in the leg, you got shot in the hand, you got shot in any of this. Chances are, you're going to have it cut off.
War is hell, but war pre-modern medicine sounds particularly hellish.
Oh God, it's awful. It really is. And also, bayonets, that's another thing. You were significantly more likely to die from a bayonet than you were from just like a standard sword. And you may wonder, oh, well, why is that the case? Because depending upon the type of bayonet that they were using, like there's bayonets that are literally just singular little blades, right? But then other bayonets that were very common to be attached onto muskets were triangular blades. Triangular blades create irregular wounds in the body, which are very hard to stitch up. Meaning you get stabbed with one of those pretty deep and it's going to do some serious damage to your body. So yes, Napoleon, as I said, would escape most of these atrocities, but he was able to recover in the meantime. And in recognition for his service there, he was promoted to Brigadier General. But more importantly, his name was now on the radar of very powerful revolutionary figures like Augustin Robespierre, who was the younger brother of the leading Jacobin Maximilian Robespierre, the guy that we talked about in the previous episode that is responsible for a whole lot of death in France. Basically, every single figure that we talk about in this is going to be responsible for a whole lot of death in one way or another. So, after being promoted to Brigadier General, Napoleon was put in charge of the defenses along the Mediterranean coast, but was quickly assigned as artillery commander to the Army of Italy. His first move there was to devise an invasion of the Kingdom of Sardinia. Located on the Italian side of the Alps, the Kingdom of Piedmont-Sardinia and its allies would control the mountain passes and garrisons that were located on the French side of the Alps. Napoleon's first move was to attack these garrisons in April of 1794, and while the French casualties were almost double of what those of the defenders were, the French still were able to capture the strategic objectives along the Alps, which in turn forced the Italians and Austrians to sign a treaty with the French at the end of May. Just 2 months later, in July, Napoleon's allies, the Robespierres, this is when they would fall from power, and the new regime was very suspect of Napoleon. They didn't trust him. This was a powerful figure, a general, or not exactly a general at this point. He was a powerful military figure, and it is not something that a Republican government typically likes at that time. He was arrested in August, but was released just 2 weeks later. And we can guess from this that it may have just been some kind of political theater or something that was being done as a kind of warning shot. Because immediately after being freed, he wasn't put on house arrest or anything like that. He was instead put back in command and tasked with devising plans to continue attacking the Italians and Austrians. The first step was a planned expedition to retake Corsica in March of 1795. But this is an island, and France didn't exactly have a good track record with its navy at this time because of the British, so the British would end up repulsing their efforts. The following month, Napoleon was reassigned to the Army of the West, which was handling the war in the Vendée, which was a royalist uprising against the revolutionary government. This was technically a demotion from an artillery command to an infantry command, and Napoleon did not want to do this. He didn't just have his ego of the later years. This is where it was kind of starting to develop for him. This was not something that he wanted to do. And he did try to get out of it by claiming to have poor health. But eventually, he would manage to get himself reassigned.
Why did they demote him?
Well, it's not so much of a demotion on purpose. There's multiple reasons. You could say that, oh, they demote him in order to make sure that he doesn't get too full of himself, that they move him around to different areas where he could be useful. The other thing that you could say is, oh, well, technically speaking, for this thing, you don't need an artillery commander. You only need this thing. Therefore, that's what we're assigning you. Really, when talking about it, it's more of a technicality than anything else.
Makes sense.
So in this case, he doesn't want to go. He gets himself reassigned, and he gets reassigned to the Bureau of Topography, which would bring him closer to Paris and more important government contacts. But that didn't save him from being removed of the list, like from the list of generals in regular service, due to the fact that he refused to serve in the Vendée campaign.
Oh, so by not doing what they assigned him, he kind of got blacklisted.
Correct. This is also a reason as to why you might do something like that in the first place, because if you give someone an undesirable assignment, if you make them do something that they don't want to do and they refuse, you as a government official now have full, I'm not going to say as a government official, you have full legal authority, but if a person was trying to get you out of doing something, that's how they could potentially get you, punish you.
Okay, all of this is great, but I must ask, at what point does he meet Josephine?
Later.
Wow, so they left all of this out of his movie.
Actually, wait, hold on. No, I think it may have actually happened prior to this, but they were courting at the time. I'm trying to actually line up in my head here the specific timeline on when it occurred. And that's the thing. Obviously, we're going to talk about stuff with Josephine that is going to go into this, but this is specifically going to talk more about what I expected the Ridley Scott movie to do in the first place, which was talk about the actual man himself who did things.
Makes sense.
So he gets blacklisted, as you said. And after this, he's like, okay, well, screw all of you. I'm going to go to Constantinople instead and serve under the Sultan, because the Ottoman Empire was an ally of France here at this time. So he asks for permission to do this, and they agree. He gets his papers, everything is set. He's able to transfer over whenever he wants. And Napoleon just doesn't go. He literally just does not leave. He stays behind. Normally, you'd think that that would be the end of a career, but his biggest break would then happen on October 3rd, when royalists in Paris would rebel against the National Convention. Paul Barras, who knew of Napoleon's actions in Toulon, he would go and bring Napoleon back into Paris. And you can imagine some kind of backroom deal was probably struck because Napoleon was placed as second in command of forces that were defending the Tuileries Palace. Napoleon and his forces would seize cannon from depots in the area and then would deploy them in strategic locations throughout the city. On October 5th, he would then open fire with his forces on the royalists with canister shot. Hundreds were immediately killed, and the uprising was quashed. Canister shot, for anyone who is not aware of this, I want you to imagine a cannon, and now I want you to imagine turning that cannon into a giant shotgun.
You said, for anyone wondering, and you look directly at me, rude.
Hey. Canister shot is actually slightly different from grape shot here. Okay. So grape shot uses like this, like a canvas bag that is tied with rope all around it. And so it looks like a bundle of grapes. Canister shot has like, it actually has way better range than grape shot because what happens is it's actually in a canister. So you have all the balls and things that are inside of it that are being fired so that when the canister gets fired, when it gets launched, it sticks together longer before gradually spreading out. And so what happens is canister shot can hit a wider group of targets, or it can hit a target that is much further away in a better grouping. It's a remarkably effective and horribly deadly tool. It's the only thing that I can imagine that is more horrifying than being just absolutely domed by canister shot is what you would see later, where they would utilize quicklime in mortars.
What's that?
Quicklime is stuff that people would end up using to dissolve bodies. I want you to imagine caustic mortar and lime that is being fired out of a mortar over top of a wall into a city with people.
What?
Yeah. We're talking about stuff that was like acidic that would literally burn the skin right off of you. It was horrifying.
And not a war crime, because those didn't exist.
Correct. Those were not a war crime. It did not exist here yet. Yeah.
Everybody shush! William Shatner has something to say.
Cat and Jethro, box of oddities.
What do you do when the woman you love dies? Well, of course you dig her up and you live with her.
Aww. Yeah.
The show examines weird things.
There are plenty of old photographs from this time period of children out in the streets playing in and among the dead horse carcasses.
Oh, I miss those days. Things used to be so much simpler.
Cat and Jethro.
Then there's the urine wheel, which sounds like a really bad game show.
Thing done weird things. Cat and Jethro, box of oddities. That is really mysterious.
Join Cat and Jethro Gilligan Toth for the strange, the bizarre, the unexpected, as they lift the lid and cautiously peer inside the box of oddities.
The Webby Award-winning Box of Oddities podcast from Airwave Media.
That's something. So Napoleon was praised for this, and he was promoted to Army of the Interior, and a few months later appointed as commander of the Army of Italy. And at this point, honestly, because we've talked about the Napoleon movie multiple times here at this point, if I was Ridley Scott and I was directing a movie about Napoleon Bonaparte, this is where, you know, me being Ridley Scott, I'm going to skip all of the things that Napoleon does in Italy. You know, arguably one of the most famous high points of his entire career because of just how much impressive stuff that he was able to do. But no, I'm not Ridley Scott, so that's not what we're going to be doing. We're actually going to talk about the really impressive stuff that he did. Things which still to this day are taught in military schools all around the world. So in March of 1796, Napoleon departs to take control of the Army of Italy. And what he finds is not good. It is a ragged, it is a demoralized army. It is something that is on the brink of mutiny and just turning on their commanders. And many of the men were starving or at least malnourished. They also lacked basic supplies. Forget food. They didn't even have weapons, muskets, ammunition, bayonets, uniforms to fight with. There were entire battalions who were going barefoot. They didn't have shoes. And the army had not been paid in literal months.
Months?
Yeah.
How do you get people to fight for you that you haven't paid in months?
Threats, coercion, national spirit. There's a lot of different tools that you could utilize.
I feel like threats wouldn't work because there'd be more of them than there are of you. So I'd really have to rely heavily on the national spirit.
Yeah, they did. And that was oftentimes one of the things that Napoleon was amazing at, being able to coerce his men into fighting well above and beyond what others would. Because I'm not going to say that they worshiped the ground that he walked on, but they wholeheartedly respected him as time would go.
That is so hard to picture if you look at the Napoleon movie for reference.
I know!
That guy couldn't make eye contact, which is cool. I can't make eye contact, never have been, but...
Do you remember that scene, Gabby, where he comes back, you know, and it's right before the Battle of Waterloo? So he comes back and the army is sent there, like that battalion of men to capture him. And he goes, "Oh, my soldiers, you may fire on me. You may do what you wish." And it's like, that's actually a real moment that happened. And they, you know, they lay down their arms. They saluted him as the emperor, and they marched with him, like they joined him instead of capturing him. So that's a real event that happened. And when you see Joaquin Phoenix, who I love, he's a great actor. He's a really good actor. When he does that in the Napoleon movie, I look at this and go, this is some man-child's fantasy right here that is just, it didn't happen.
It was just really interesting to watch because I pictured him as like this great ruler who was like great with people, but he had the people skills of me.
He had the people skills of you on one of your bad days, Gabby, like a hormonal bad day.
Like me just having like a really bad day and like absolutely A, I'm bad with looking people in the eye, and B, just not leadership quality. It was really sad.
No, there was nothing that actually said, oh, this is Napoleon. He is a great commander. Like that's what pissed me off. In this case, though, the army that he was taking control of, if it was at full strength, should have had around 100,000 men or so. And as it stood, there was only around 37,000 soldiers and 60 pieces of artillery. There was no prospect of reinforcement. They had no money to resupply. Napoleon was going to have to be self-sufficient. As a side note, many of the famous names who would go on to be very high-ranking officers during the French Empire, they were involved in this campaign. Berthier, Arago, Massena, Murat, Junot, Joubert, and Marmont. All these different figures that would be huge figures in Napoleon's campaign, they specifically came about at this moment. First impressions from these officers, they weren't impressed. They did not think really anything of this 26-year-old boy, effectively, who looked more like an intellectual than a soldier. But they were very quickly disabused of their impressions when Napoleon immediately reorganized the commissariat and threatened the contractors who were supposed to be supplying the army to bring down their extortionist prices. That, coupled with the loan that he managed to secure from Genoese bankers, allowed him to improve conditions for the men. He also reorganized mutinous units to spread them in with loyal ones and court-martialed anti-revolutionary officers. For a general who had yet to lead a field army, Napoleon was about to take on 53,000 Austrian and Piedmontese troops with a smaller and less provisioned army of 37,000 men. And that's it. This is going to bring us into the Italian campaigns. The Kingdom of Piedmont-Sardinia had been at war with the French Republic since 1793. But think of it as mostly being a proxy war between France and Austria. Austria was financing the Piedmontese and providing manpower to continue fighting France, but the Piedmontese were not exactly happy about their relationship with Austria and didn't really trust them. The Austrian commander had also been warned not to trust the Piedmontese. And so it's against this backdrop that we can begin to understand just how Napoleon, with an inferior force, was actually able to take on their combined forces. Napoleon would open his campaign with an attack on the village of Montenotte on April 12th. His first victory as commander-in-chief of an army, he would quickly follow up this victory with two more at the Battle of Millesimo on April 13th and the Battle of Dago on April 14th. This rapid series of battles would force the Austrian and Piedmontese forces to separate during the retreat. Napoleon would pursue the Piedmontese army from that and would launch a full-scale invasion of the kingdom. He would defeat them within the week, and the Kingdom of Piedmont-Sardinia would sue for peace on April 28th. This was ridiculously fast. And it was the first of many displays where Napoleon would combine divide and conquer tactics with breakneck speed, with other armies of this era just not being able to deal with it at all. Like, you got to think, Gabby, this is the late 18th century going into, after this, the early 19th century. Armies did not move very fast. Like, you didn't have nearly as much speed for this. The day of cavalry, this isn't like it's a Hunnic tribe or anything.
So you always had to have enough food, enough supplies, enough warmth, enough everything.
And baggage with massive amounts of infantry trailing behind an army of 30 to 100,000 men? That is a very slow-moving entity.
Was it possible for soldiers to just take essential supplies on their person and leave the supply caravan behind?
Gabby, guess what you just described?
A bad idea?
You just described Napoleon's tactics.
Oh, genius. See? I'm Napoleon.
Literally. Gabby, you literally just figured out all one of the key things to his success. This is also why, and I know this is a little bit of a spoiler. I don't know why I would say this is a spoiler. This is also the thing that would end up coming back to bite him in the ass when he would invade Russia.
Did his supply caravans get caught up?
He would leave his supply caravans behind as he moved his forces forward. The supply caravans were constantly being raided. And on top of that, they would usually have his forces live off the land as they moved. And the Russians burned and poisoned their countryside as they retreated so that he couldn't come in and actually take anything. Every village they passed, they destroyed all the food so that there was no way for the French army to resupply themselves.
See, he should have just had them put more food in their backpacks. Like, just the only thing they carried was a weapon and then a giant bag of food.
Just a giant bag of food.
Because the average man, I guess, could carry what? Half their body weight easily?
I guess. I don't even know what the actual statistic on that is.
I think I could lift half my body weight, but I don't know if it would be easily. But as a guy, a fit soldier, they could theoretically put a lot of food on themselves and just trek.
You know, yeah, they could. But then also there's the ammunition. Muskets were also really heavy. I got to take you to that antique firearm shop when we go there so you can hold up one of these things. The musket that's like as big as you are tall. And it's just...
See, I didn't think about the weapons. I was just thinking about the food.
I mean, if you want to go, we're backpackers with fisticuffs. That's all that the army is. It's an army of Shaolin monks just running across the field.
Like, you get there and you're like, okay, drop all arms.
Everyone, brass knuckles, equip. Let's go. So, yes, this is the kind of tactic that he would utilize. And Napoleon was incredibly clever. He would include in his treaty with the Piedmont a secret clause that would allow him to use a bridge that crossed the River Po. Because he knew that this would leak to the Austrians, who would then promptly set up defenses, who were anticipating Napoleon's move on the bridge. However, he didn't care about the bridge. This was a ruse. This was designed to make them go there and try and defend that one spot. Instead, he made his crossing at another location around 70 miles to the east. The Austrians were completely taken by surprise, and from there, they were forced to withdraw to protect the city of Milan. The French would then pursue them and would engage the enemy at the town of Lodi. Napoleon had to get across the bridge there in order to get to the Austrian army. And the Austrians at this place would be forced to try and destroy their bridge to prevent the French from crossing. And so waves upon waves upon waves of French soldiers attempted to cross the bridge under heavy fire, eventually establishing a bridgehead and forcing the Austrians to withdraw. In itself, the Battle of Lodi, it wasn't very significant for the Austrians, as they were already retreating. Both sides would also suffer equal casualties. But the battle was a propaganda coup for Napoleon, which initiated the legend of the determined bravery of French soldiers who would serve under him. The victory would also earn Napoleon his soldiers' love, who would affectionately call him the Little Corporal. And that was just his nickname that he would carry on. The Battle of Lodi would also be the thing, though, that would create a political problem. It is what would make the Directory fear his popularity, because Napoleon wasn't just a popular French general anymore. He had the potential to become the next Julius Caesar, and they could see that. So what they tried to do first was they attempted to have him split command with General Kellerman of the Army of the Alps. Bonaparte not only refused, he threatened to resign. And not willing to risk Napoleon leaving, because remember, the state is quite literally still at war with everyone around them and they need all the talented commanders that they can get, the Directory was forced to abandon the plan. On the May 15th, 1796, the French army would then enter Milan, who were very happy to get rid of the Austrians, because mind you, almost all of the Italian-occupied areas, I say Italian-occupied, the Austrian-occupied areas of Italy, they didn't like the Austrians. Like, they were an unpopular ruler for a long period of time. And so they were ever so happy to just let the French in. Napoleon would reorganize the government, not as a direct controlled thing by the French, but rather a satellite republic of France. And he would also levy a total of 20 million francs from Milan, Parma, Modena, and the Army of Italy was finally paid with real money for the first time in literally 3 years. Remember, everything that they were getting prior to this was literally promissory notes, slips of paper that was just giant IOUs. That's it. But finally, he was able to pay his forces, and this is after stunning victories to completely take over Italy. You can imagine the effect that this was going to have on the morale of the men and would inspire them to continue to fight for more rewards. The next major accomplishment in Italy was a series of victories in early August against the divided Austrian armies. Once again, Napoleon would use his speed to engage one army and then would turn around to face the other. The Austrians would withdraw, and this in turn would allow Napoleon to besiege the fortress of Mantua. Austrian relief armies were then defeated in August and September, and a third attempt to relieve the siege of Mantua was launched in November. A series of indecisive battles would take place until on November 15th, Napoleon would attack the Austrian army at the Battle of Arcole. It was at this battle where Napoleon would solidify the legend of his own personal bravery. The fiercest fighting would take place over a bridge over a small river, and an initial wave of French troops was repulsed. But Napoleon would seize a flag and would charge across the bridge himself with a second wave. One of Napoleon's aides was standing next to him and was killed, and Napoleon also probably would have been killed if he wasn't knocked off the bridge into the marshy ground beneath it. Like, he would do this stuff himself. Like, he wasn't just a guy who would just order his men to go and die, right? He was perfectly willing to get down there and do it with them if the timing was right. And he would. The battle would last two more days, but the French would eventually succeed in capturing the bridge, and after this would force the Austrians to withdraw. Another relief attempt was made by the Austrians in January, which would culminate in the decisive Battle of Rivoli. This being where the French would kill 4,000 Austrians and capture another 8,000 in comparison to just 3,000 French casualties. The French victory would force Mantua to surrender in early February, and over 16,000 Austrian soldiers had died of starvation and disease in the siege, as well as thousands of civilians. The fall of Mantua would open the road to Vienna, the Austrian capital. In March of 1797, Napoleon would lead 40,000 men through Tyrol on its way to Vienna. They would fight some minor battles, but the Austrians were terrified by this point to commit a major engagement. With the path to Vienna open, the Austrians were finally ready to negotiate a peace. Napoleon's supply lines were also stretched across the Alps, and he was not sure that he was going to be able to maintain his forces on the Austrian side of the Alps. The resulting treaty is known as the Treaty of Campo Formio, which would officially end the war of the First Coalition. Now, Napoleon had no actual authority to negotiate a treaty on behalf of the French Republic. Like, that is not something that was supposed to happen. But both sides seemed to be rather content with the outcome. The treaty would force Austria to acknowledge France's annexation of Belgium and all territory west of the Rhine River. Austria would also have to recognize the Cisalpine Republic, and this being the entity that had created by Napoleon in northern Italy. And the only concession that Austria was granted was an equal partitioning of the Republic of Venice with the Cisalpine Republic, which is something that would end Venice's 1,200-year existence. at least as an independent city. Obviously, the city itself would still exist, but it was no longer its own independent entity. Napoleon's campaign in Italy was vitally important to his own popularity in Paris. He would become a celebrity back home and renowned throughout the French Empire. One reason for his surge in popularity was his writing of reports back to Paris that were published in local media. And rather than, you know, the dry, typical reports of what you would see of other generals around the empire that they would send to Paris, Napoleon would model his own writings on, can you guess it? Can you guess some other big, important, historical, political general figure that is massively important to Western Europe? Julius Caesar. He modeled himself off of Julius Caesar and would write back in the same kind of style that Caesar would do when he would write back to the Senate in Rome. And it was a brilliant use of propaganda that would set him apart from other commanders, because now the common people were hearing all about his exploits.
Didn't Napoleon, I mean, great writer as he is, write once to Josephine saying, be home in 3 days, don't wash?
If I recall correctly, I don't think there was actual ever proof that that was a thing. It's one of those things that was commonly said, but I don't actually remember if that whole thing was legit or not.
I saw it on a TikTok, so it may not be legit.
But we want to believe that it is.
After Julius Caesar, who once wrote to his wife, be home in 3 days, don't wash. I'm just going to make this like worse.
No, that Gabby, that wasn't Julius Caesar writing the letter. That was his rival, Cato's sister, who was writing to him to tell him to not wash.
Did he sleep with his rival's sister?
So there's that whole story about Julius Caesar in the Senate during the aftermath of the Catiline conspiracy, where he was being accused as being a part of this thing. And a aide came in with a letter that was addressed to Caesar. And so Caesar went to go open it. And mind you, this is in the middle of this senatorial hearing. So Cato, who's one of his big rivals, then goes, oh, no. You're not going to get a secret missive. You're going to open that up and we're going to have that read aloud to the entire Senate floor, only for them to discover that it was a literal love letter from Cato's sister addressed to Caesar.
It be like that sometimes.
So the whole thing was obviously a political setup that was done to massively embarrass Cato. Yeah. There's no way it just happened as a coincidence.
I love that, though. Is that real?
It's real from the stories that we have. We have no actual, again, definitive proof that it happened, but the histories about the moment say that it did happen.
I love drama. Oh, my God. I would pay money to be there just to see his face.
I know, right? So you know how old Napoleon is at the point that all this has happened?
25.
Well, actually close. He is 28. He is a year younger than I am right now at the time that I'm making this. And
he's my age. I haven't conquered anyone.
Me? I'm going to send you into a coughing fit right now. Just Gabby, go and release it. Release the cough.
I'm trying so hard not to. I refuse.
I know that a whole bunch of people, there's probably going to be so many comments on YouTube when this goes up at this exact moment for anyone who put this in. And no one's going to be sticking around, I'm sure, to the very last moment, or very few people usually stick all the way through the episode while they're listening here. But still, that is, I had to. Still, at the age of 28 years old, Napoleon had effectively changed the map of Northern Italy. He defeated the Austrians, who were previously considered to have some of the best soldiers in Europe. And he had achieved popularity in Paris and around the entire continent. Despite all this, though, he was just beginning. Next time, we're going to be continuing into Napoleon's adventures into Egypt, his crowning as the Emperor of the French, and his continued wars across Europe before ultimately, of course, things come to an end.
And thank you to our admin, Azer, for writing this episode and researching it. Great job.
I appreciate all of you who are listening. I appreciate all the help that comes from the staff that helps to create these in the first place. Thank you all, my friends. And we'll see you all next time. Goodbye, guys.
Bye.